Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Welcome to Slow Pitch, a podcast that takes sports movies too seriously, or perhaps not seriously enough. We're your hosts.
Hey, Brad. No tan lines today. Looking good.
And Brad Etherly, you've had that in your trousers all day? Two guys who consider watching sports movies a type of aerobic exercise. Today's episode is a review of the 1989 classic, The Burbs. So this will be fun because I've known you for 26, 27 years, something like that. And I would say I know your tastes. I know, you know, what you think is funny. I think I know what kind of TV shows and movies you like. Right. I know that you love Rob Thomas. And when he did his duet with Santana, like you couldn't stop playing repeat.
Yeah.
So I think I know you, but I am not sure where you fall on The Burbs.
So it's going to be an interesting conversation. Yeah.
Well, I'll say this. I think this is just an absolute joy of a film to watch. I saw it in the theater with my dad and immediately thought it was just absolutely hilarious. And it doesn't disappoint.
Yeah. I will tell you this. It is not the Carlos Santana, Rob Thomas of movies. And yeah, we can talk more about my personal take later, but it is far from whatever that lick laden song is. I don't even remember what it's called.
I forget too.
Yeah.
I'll say this. So the premise, if you haven't ever watched it, go out and watch it immediately. I think it's a comedy classic. And I'll say this too. It's a shame that Tom Hanks really stopped doing the broad comedy like this. I feel like comedic Hanks is a great Hanks, and I miss that about him.
Yeah. Well, he had done Big the year before this, and I believe he was nominated for an Academy Award for it.
Yeah, that's right.
And this might have been his very next movie. Because I know this came out in February of 1989. But yeah, he gave us early in his career, we had Splash and Bachelor Party. And then obviously Bosom Buddies, where he was very, that's like as broad as comedy gets, like literal broad comedy. But yeah, it's a little bit, it's like he maybe got a little Oscar sniff and didn't want to leave that behind. Although, interestingly enough about Tom Hanks, and I don't know if you read this or not, he did not want to be a dad in this movie. He did not want them to cast him as having a son because he thought if he was seen as a dad, he wouldn't be able to go back to being Bachelor Party Tom Hanks. Is that what I read?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's not like Bachelor Party Tom Hanks was peak Tom Hanks by any means. Like,
yeah,
you know, he had done a lot of comedies. You know, he did the Money Pit. He did The Man with One Red Shoe. And then he got kind of serious for Punchline. But then Big came out and that kind of was a huge, huge hit. And then this one. And then, you know, he had a couple after this, like Joe versus the Volcano that didn't hit on all notes. But no, he didn't want to be, I think it was said that he didn't want to be a Fred McMurray type. And to that, I pose, what's wrong with a Fred McMurray type?
Yeah. Well, and he played, was in Dragnet. Right, Turner before this Hooch. Movie, Turner Hooch, Yeah. Turner and Hooch was his movie after the Burbs. And it's been a while since I've seen Turner and Hooch, but I believe he is not playing a dad to at least a human in that. So it's not, I think he was even Tom Hanks can be a little overly paranoid. And then plus, like, I would say the movie that really spun him into true, like, upper echelon fame was one where he did play a dad, which was Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah.
He was sort of the dad that everybody felt sorry for. And he had good chemistry with that kid. And
well, and I don't know if the script was changed while they were shooting, but it's not like the father character was a huge portion of this movie. You know, the kid is more or less not even seen. It's like everybody loves Raymond's kids. They're you know, they're not really integral to the story.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how much Hank's complaining played into that.
Yeah, I don't know, but
that's even weird to even say. Like, Tom Hanks does not seem like a guy who's complaining about anything on set. Like, the 2021 version of Tom Hanks, he's just like, hey, yeah, whatever. Sounds good. I'll go act in that. Yeah, sure, sounds good. Like, he's America's dad that was the first person that we all knew that got COVID. And
well, he's Mr. Rogers. And ironically, Mr. Rogers is in this movie.
He watches an episode of Mr. Rogers in this. That's right.
Crazy. But so Hanks, though, he turns a great comedic performance. But beyond him, I think that the supporting cast is just as good. But one of those supporting cast members, he apparently didn't get along with that great, but his easygoing style just went with it and made the best of it. But that was who I think is one of the best sidekicks and a sidekick character in film history, who is Art Weingartner. And he's played by a guy that is not just one of those guys that you would just know off the top of your head. And his name is Rick Dukeman, something like that.
Was he a stand-up comedian or something?
I think so. I think that he was a stand-up. And he played bit parts in a lot of movies, but definitely nothing as kind of front and center as this movie. But I thought he knocked it out of the park as well.
Yeah. Well, in this movie, like, it occupies kind of an interesting territory. Like, this feels like a Tim Burton movie if Tim Burton weren't hellbent on being weird at all times. Like, it's like it's Tim Burton where the Tim Burton-ness is dialed down to like a six.
It's a little restrained. Yeah. It really does, I think, play the comedy slash horror combo really well, because it's not exactly it's not like scary, like you're going to jump out of your seat, but it's just eerie enough in places. But the comedy shines through above all and just is absolutely hilarious. But Art, man, I could have used about 15 of his quotes throughout the movie. I don't know if you caught the one where he and Corey Feldman are telling the story about Skip, and you know, Tom Hanks gets all nervous and everything, and then Corey Feldman kind of spooks Tom Hanks so that he does jump out of his seat. And Art, did you catch the quote after that?
Remind me.
Jump a little higher, Spud Webb.
Yeah. That would have to be explained to anybody who's watching The Burbs for the first time.
But just a hilarious line that was barely audible, something I had never heard before in my many viewings of the movie, and I thought it was hilarious.
And okay, I don't want to like shift gears too quickly, but you know, we're talking about The Burbs and the fact that it came out in early 1989. Have you ever looked at the roster of of like the 1989 movie roster, like movies that came out that year?
I mean, just off the top of my head, I know Field of Dreams probably came out that year. What else?
Well, let me run some down for you. In February, you had The Burbs come out. You also had Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure come out. In March, you had, Lean on Me come out.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had Police Academy 6. I know that we were all...
Classic.
Yeah. We had Troop Beverly Hills, which I think is... And Heathers.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, Heathers came out in March of that year. In April, you have... This we'll be doing this movie at some point. Major League came out.
Oh, yeah.
Say Anything came out in mm-hmm. that year, in April of that year. Like you said, Field of Dreams. The first Pet Sematary came out. Let's see, we get into May. Let's see, I'm going down. See No Evil, Hear No Evil.
That's a great one.
It is a great one. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Now we're getting into the summer blockbusters. You have Dead Poets Society came out, Ghostbusters 2, Batman, the first Michael Keaton Batman,
yeah.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Do the Right Thing, Karate Kid Part 3, Lethal Weapon 2, as far as sequels go, it's a pretty amazing movie. When Harry Met Sally, which yeah. is... Sleepless in
rom-com. Yeah. Yeah, it's a rom-com classic.
Yeah, rom-com classic. UHF, which is a personal favorite of mine.
Amazing.
And I might request it on the next Out of Bounds episode. Turner and Hooch came out. Parenthood, which I think is a classic. Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is considered a classic. Uncle Buck came out that year. Who's Harry Crumb came out early in the year. I think I've... Let's get there.
How could you skip yes, over right. that?
Anyway, you get my point. Like that movie is just like, or that year is just chocked full of amazing movies that we all remember, like, you know, the Batmans and Bill and Ted's and all that stuff. And so it is not it like when you think about it, like if the fact that we're talking about The Burbs is a testament to the uniqueness of that movie.
It is. I will say this, too. It's interesting to hear you rattle off that list, and I'm sure you could have provided even more, but it's interesting to me to hear how many comedies are in that list that were, you know, popular and beloved and are still viewed as classics. And I feel like nowadays, comedies are either kind of raunchy, gross-out adult comedies or... not comedies at all, you know, and it's sad that they don't make the likes of Who's Harry Crumb.
Yeah. Well, you know, money drives a lot of things, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know the movie industry, but I do know that, you know, there are a few directors who can get away with making offbeat movies. Wes Anderson, you know, mm-hmm. his budgets aren't blockbuster-esque, but big stars want to be in his movies, and studios know that people want to see big stars acting and on screen, and so they'll put up the money to do that for a guy like him, or maybe a Sofia Coppola or Greta Gerwig or someone like that. But because money drives so much, I do know that superhero movies or just any movie that can play well overseas is huge. And like movies where things are exploding or where the jokes are easy to get, like the comedy's really broad. Like if you have a really conceptual movie that relies on everybody speaking English or people knowing American pop culture or whatever, it may not do as well overseas. And so it just doesn't get the love. And here's another thing that I think plays into this a little bit, like when you talk about 1989 versus now, everything's so fragmented now. Like used to have the ability to have like this monoculture where, okay, Michael Keaton Batman is coming out and the whole world, it seemed like at least at the time, knows that the Michael Keaton Batman's coming out. You're seeing commercials for it on TV. It's on McDonald's cups. Mm-hmm. There's there's like four TV channels, and so you're not being bombarded by Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and all this stuff. It's like everybody's going to go see this movie, and everyone's probably going to go see this movie like five different times, and then everyone's going to talk about it. It's going to be the topic of conversation at parties and at church potlucks and all this stuff. And so, yeah, like, I think like that is gone. Like, I feel like people don't talk about Justice League or the Zack Snyder cut of Batman versus Superman, whatever. I don't know, whatever it is now. Like, people just aren't talking about it as much because everybody's inside their own headphones watching their own thing.
But this movie, I think that it has officially attained a cult-like status among movie buffs, and for good reason. I mentioned the art is one of the best sidekicks in film history, but it doesn't stop there. I mean, Bruce Dern as, I don't know, the general or the colonel or whatever, Mark Rumsfeld is amazing. And the thing that I think about this movie is that it really doesn't miss a beat. Like, every single joke, to me at least, hits. There's absolutely nothing that is there. There's only one moment, and we can get to that later, that I would change about this movie. But Bruce Dern does a great job. Carrie Fisher, even Corey Feldman has some good laughs as a minor character in the movie.
I have a question. But what did Corey Feldman's parents exist at all in this? Because like, I was watching this, Alicia and I were watching this together, and she said, "Wait, is he old enough to own a house?" I was like, "I don't think he doesn't own the house." I was like, "He's just a teenager who lives in the neighborhood."
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're never around. I mean, what is he? Maybe 17. It's interesting.
And I was also wondering this. Like, he seems a lot like his character in Lost Boys, which I think came out fairly close to this movie. And so I wonder if it was like a parallel universe where like his family moved from wherever in California where Lost Boys took place to this neighborhood. And so now he's the same guy.
Yeah. And wasn't Lost Boys about, I've only seen Lost Boys once, and it was a long time ago. Wasn't it about vampires?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it definitely was. And I won't get us sidetracked on that, but I'll just say Google Lost Boys saxophone scene. And,
okay. And thank me. Corey Haim?
It's both Corey's. Okay. Yeah. Double dose of Corey and triple dose of amazing saxophone.
Okay.
At some point we need to have a St. Elmo's Fire versus Lost Boys saxophone scene off, like just to figure out which one's
maybe
more amazing.
Maybe a mini episode. Yeah. But yeah, Bruce Dern is amazing. He plays this ex-Vietnam type. I don't know that he was officially in Vietnam because they kind of act like he wanted to be in Vietnam. But I mean, every single thing that these characters do just makes me laugh. At one point, I remember Bruce Dern calling Tom Hanks a fraidy cat, which is just a hilarious term for a 60-year-old to use to a 35-year-old, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so the movie is Tom Hanks is this suburbanite dad who is taking some vacation. Carrie Fisher is his wife, and she wants to go out to the lake, but he wants to just hang out at the house. But he's got some new neighbors that are, you know, they don't take care of the house, which did that house automatically become in disrepair when the Klopex moved in, or had it been in disrepair for 25 years? Because what was it? The Knapps that lived there before obviously didn't take care of that house either.
No, I think a house to be in that kind of disrepair takes longer than a couple weeks or a month.
Yeah.
Or however long they lived there.
Yeah.
Did I read somewhere where one of those houses, like I read that was shot on like a Warner Brothers lot or something, and
Universal.
And one of those houses was the Munsters house.
It was Corey Feldman's house. The Munsters house, which I wondered about because they had to, it was actually shot on the same lot that the Leave It to Beaver show was shot on. as well, and they tore down the Cleaver's house to build Tom Hanks's house.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is like sacrilege. I know.
Crazy. But here's my question. If you've got the Munsters' house, why not use that as the Klopek's house?
Do you think people would recognize it as the Munsters' house and be like, they're using the Munsters' house?
I think that they thought in 1989 people would, but I'm not so sure that people would have had that memory just etched into their head.
Well, I might disagree because many a day I got home from school and on TBS, the Munsters was on. So I had that house burned into my frontal lobe. But here's the thing, like, did they move the house? Did they like physically move the Munsters' house?
I didn't read about that. I think that they just used it, but they tried not to show too much of the exterior. So that's why you see Feldman on his porch, and that's kind of, they're all kind of tight, close shots of his porch.
There's an episode of Different Strokes where Arnold goes to he goes to Hollywood for some reason, and he goes up to the Munsters' house on that episode. Just a side note.
There you go.
It's another thing.
Arnold Drummond trivia right there.
Yeah, Arnold Drummond.
So anyways, he gets intrigued by these neighbors. There's a lot of weird noises coming out of the house at night. And he's got these two neighbors, Art and Bruce Dern's character, who kind of join him in this, like, it's almost like it's a great idea that really hadn't been explored much before, or if it had, it hadn't become a popular idea, in that you've got these, you know, young adult to middle-aged people that are living in the suburbs, kind of like the kids from Leave It to Beaver, but instead of the kids getting in the trouble, it's these adults who, for whatever reason, are not working. I understand Tom Hanks is on vacation and Bruce Dern is probably retired, but what is Art doing?
They're like, when they were writing this, they're probably like, okay, we can have one screw up, or we can kind of make excuses. Like, the guy's retired military and the other guy's on vacation. Then we can just have one guy who's kind of a screw up and, you know, maybe he's on unemployment or something.
But they get into all these hijinks and so they're trying to determine what's going on in this house. These guys never come out. They only come out at night, and it's, you know, just an eerie feeling that they have regarding these neighbors. So basically it becomes a movie of, I dare you to do this, you know, over and over and over again, where, you know, at first it's a simple, you know, go up and knock on the door kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's where you get your first, you know, real good bit of physical comedy where they knock on the door, the address is 669, the 9 turns into a 6.
Yeah.
They do it again, the bees come out, you know, of the house. They run into the street. Bruce Dern's character is working on his garden, so he takes his garden hose and is like, come run to the water, but then gets yanked by the, you know, and I remember as a 14-year-old just thinking that that was some of the greatest physical comedy I'd ever seen. But another funny, well, so then they kind of hatch all these ideas and these schemes to figure them out. And one night they're looking at the house through like a night vision finder, and all of a sudden the garage door opens up, and Courtney Gaines, who is who's one of the Klopeks,
he's Kenneth.
Courtney Gaines,
Kenneth, yeah. From Can't Buy Me Love. Yeah,
he does a great job too as playing a complete, like, just weirdy, you know, weird looking freak. But he comes out, puts a garbage bag in a trash can made to look like it's got a human body in it, and takes a hoe and just starts pounding it and just pounding it with like the thunder clapping as each pound with the hoe.
Yeah.
And another great line after that, he gets back in the car and drives back into the garage, and Tom Hanks goes, I've never seen that. I've never seen someone drive their garbage to the corner, beat it with a hoe, and then drive back into the garage.
Well, okay. And let's, okay. We need to give Hank some Tom Hanks credit. Cause like at this point, even though he's had some successful movies, Tom Hanks is not Tom Hanks yet. But I feel like this material in somebody else's hands is not gonna, it's not like the line you just said, it's not gonna be what it is without Tom Hanks performing it. But he's kind of bringing that Tom Hanks energy to every scene that kind of makes it sort of like makes this movie work in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, there's another scene before that where he's like slapping his chest and it's like he's doing this Tom Hanks bit that I don't know that anybody else is capable of doing. And he does it a couple of times where he breaks into almost a mania, especially at the end where he goes after Art.
Yeah.
You know, another great scene. But he just has this Tom Hanks quality that after this movie, I don't know how many more times he exhibits that on film.
Well, you get it a little bit in Castaway. Like he has a lot of time by himself just to sort of go crazy, quote unquote, while he's on the island. And so, you know, he's talking to a volleyball and getting to sort of exhibit sort of that manic thing there. But yeah, you know, he's very reserved in movies like You've Got Mail. And
yeah.
And of course, I think the Toy Stories come along pretty soon after this, but.
True. But the reason I really brought up the garbage scene is because it sets up, I think, a theme for the movie that is really smart as well. And that so they view Hans Klopek destroying this garbage bag. And so they have this idea of, hey, we need to check out what's in the garbage. But they wait till the morning and they're woken up the next morning to the garbage truck coming down the street. And because I'm an old man now, I have to watch all my movies with subtitles on. And one thing I had also never paid attention to was Bruce Dern is the first one to come out of the house. And so he starts running down the street after the garbage truck to stop them from putting the garbage in the garbage truck. And he's yelling, he's calling the garbage men, "Hey, Garbies, Garbies," which I just thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
But then Art actually jumps into the garbage truck looking for this. No, it was Art. It wasn't Bruce Dern. It was Art who was calling him Garbies.
Garbies.
Yeah. And then Bruce Dern comes in and another just perfect moment where he's obviously been shaving, but he's only got shaving cream on half of his face. Like, just pitch perfect. But yeah, I thought that was a hilarious scene where Art comes running out. You know, Art does another one where, you know, he's trying to convince Tom Hanks that these are devil worshipers or Satanists. And he starts chanting in the basement. They've got like this old, like, 1500 book that's about devil worshiping, and he breaks into this chant of Satan is good, Satan is our pal, I want to kill everyone. Just amazing stuff. But what I was gonna get at as far as what the movie does that's smart is that it kind of keeps that continuity throughout the film of things that have happened, because you kind of forget about the trash scene happening where they're just throwing trash everywhere in the street. And like maybe 15 minutes later, they do this whole pan of the cul-de-sac that they live on. And there's this huge pile of trash. It's like the next day. And all that trash is just left out in the street. Yeah. And I just thought that was, and they do that again, like where later on in the movie, the Klopeks have this big, like, Great Dane that comes shooting out of a screen door. And then later on, they show that screen door and it's all taped up. Yeah. And I just thought that was a great, smart addition to the movie, that if you just pay a little close attention to everything that's happened, you'll notice those things later on in the movie.
Yeah. Yes. Like, this is, I mean, we were talking about, you're asking, like, you know, how do I feel about this movie? I appreciate any movie that can't be put into a category necessarily. It's kind of like, all right, you've got Die Hard and Snakes on a Plane and Speed. You can put all those into a category. You can put The Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles. You put those into a category, so on and so forth. You cannot put The Burbs into a category. And I would even say you can't put it into a horror. You can't put it into a mystery or suspense because it's too comedic for that kind of stuff. And the quirky attention to detail, like you're pointing out, being half shaven and all that stuff. And just kind of like maybe like the movie never like spells anything out for you. It kind of like leaves you like these little things that you get to see and find. When you do discover them, it's even more enjoyable. And every character is just kind of like oozing personality. And I read that there was a lot of improv-ing in this.
Yeah.
Which I can't remember why. There was a reason.
Well, there was a writer strike.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so, and that, who knows, if there hadn't been a writer strike, it might've lost some of its charm, but yeah, just like every character is like, okay, I'm going to squeeze as much out of every scene as I can. That's not always going to work. It works in this movie.
Yeah. And again, you know, like you were saying, it was so funny, even as a 14, or I guess I was just 13 when it came out. You know, I thought it was hilarious, but I was for real kind of freaked out by the Klopex, you know, especially Courtney Gaines. Courtney Gaines, his makeup is great. And his style of just looking completely disheveled and like he's never seen the light of day.
All right, let's pause on Courtney Gaines for a second. Is there a guy how do I want to phrase this? Is there a guy who has a name that sounds more athletic but is less athletic looking than Courtney Gaines? Because it sounds like, starting it forward for the North Carolina Tar Heels, number 41, Courtney Gaines. And you see the guy, and it looks like, you know, if you tossed him a basketball, it would bounce off of an accordion that he's playing or something.
Hilarious. Yeah, I can't think of one offhand, but yeah, it's true. But again, he does a great job, and his family, the Klopex, do a great job. But eventually, Carrie Fisher, who plays Tom Hanks's wife, just gets sick and tired of the hijinks that these guys get into, and so they all get together and decide to go into the house to just introduce themselves to them. And of course, the interior is just as creepy as the exterior. I'm not going to go beat for beat for everything throughout the plot, but they basically decide that, you know, everything is good. And we haven't even talked about Walter. Walter is the other neighbor that is kind of the old man who lives alone, but has a little dog, and the dog goes and poops on everybody's yard. And so then Walter goes missing. They break into Walter's house. You know, they find this toupee. They concoct this. It reminds me of what we did in fifth grade. Like, yeah, we went out into the woods a lot, and we would find little things, and we concocted like this whole story that there was this hermit out in the woods. We found like a saw out there. Mm-hmm. And so we concocted this whole idea that this hermit was a murderer who used this saw to kill people, you know, and it was just, this is what it reminds me of. These guys are just finding every little thing to come up with more evidence in their mind that the Klopex are murdering people. But they go to their house, they decide that everybody's fine, everybody's weird, but they aren't murderers. And then Tom Hanks has this kind of about face where he's like all of a sudden very cool. Like, he's kind of playing it up as like he's freaked out by all these guys. Then all of a sudden he's Mr. Cool Guy. And he is agreeing with his wife that, yeah, no, they're fine, they're good, they're perfect angels. But then he pulls Art and Bruce Dern's character away and is like, look, I've got Walter's toupee. And they all freak out. And Then they find like a thigh bone, a femur in the backyard. Anyway, it's all just kind of hijinks, but they decide to break into the Klopek's house.
I'm going over the fence, and I'm not coming back till I find a dead body.
When they know they're going to be away. And again, hijinks ensue. The house gets blown up, which there's no way Hanks survives that blast.
No, there's no way. You suspend a lot of disbelief in this movie, which is not a bad thing.
But it's good. It's all fun. But yeah, it's, you know, when Art gets electrocuted, I laughed my pants off when I was 13. Yeah, there's just a lot of great stuff.
Let me ask you this. Did your dad like this movie when he took you to see it?
You know what? I don't have any recollection of his. I think that he enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he thought it was just absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
My mom always tells me about how when he went to go see Blazing Saddles, they went to go see Blazing Saddles together.
Yeah. That, on a date, they went on to see that.
I don't know if they were married yet or not, but they went to go see it together, and he was literally on the floor laughing, rolling around. So he's got a great sense of humor, but I just don't recall what he thought about this movie.
Yeah. My dad introduced me to this movie. Like I didn't see it when I was in the theater, and I, like maybe a year or two later, he was like, "Oh, you need to watch this movie. It's funny."
Yeah. That's great.
And I remember him for some reason. I remember him like thinking that Corey Feldman was really funny in the movie. Also, this question for you. This is like, now we sort of blame social media and the internet on conspiracy theories starting. But here we see it starting on just in a cul-de-sac.
It's an organic.
Yeah,
it's an organic.
So this rumor could have spread about, like fake news could have spread about this family on this street, even though it turned out to not be fake news.
Yeah, it was very not fake news. Well, it reminds me of, I think I was a senior in high school, and I'm interested. I think I've probably talked to you about this before, but I'm interested to relearn if you heard this rumor, because it was something that I think kind of hit nationwide. You know, Saved by the Bell, of which you're a huge fan of, no joke, like the Carlos Santana, Rob Thomas joke earlier.
See, I do have high class tastes.
So. Yes. It had kind of ended its run by the time I was, you know, a junior. I mean, they went on to do bigger and better things like the college years, but.
Hold up. I wouldn't call the college years bigger and better things. That was a clear downgrade. Anyway.
But anyways, I heard this rumor that what's his name?
Mark Paul Gosselaar. This is
that he had died in a car wreck.
Oh really?
Did you hear that rumor?
No, I did not.
It was something that I know that when I got to Harding University the next year, many people throughout the country had heard that same rumor.
Yeah.
And so it was one of those organic, you know, rumors that had kind of hit this is before the internet. This is before social media.
Yeah. Well, you know, so. Yeah. I mean, I believe it because even though I didn't hear it, but you know, think about something like Jingle Bells, Batman Smells, Robin Laid an Egg.
Sure.
Like, you go ask any person who was alive in the 80s and 90s and they've heard that, even though there was no internet to propel it ever. It just was passed down orally.
It's one of those social phenomena that that I do find interesting. But this was a micro organic cul-de-sac conspiracy theory. But it was a great one. So the end of the movie, just to wrap it up, you know, Tom Hanks is blasted out of a house. Another funny little scene is when he comes out, his back is literally like smoking, and he stumbles out of this house. And instead of taking the steps one at a time, he kind of does this slide thing down the steps, makes me laugh every time. And then, you know, he's absolutely 100% convinced that there is nothing wrong with this family. Art is still trying to prove that they are evil murderers. And but, you know, there's ambulances, there's firemen. Art and Tom Hanks get into a hilarious fight where Art tries to bite Tom Hanks's splinted finger. And then Tom Hanks is just exhausted, so he throws himself in an ambulance. And turns out that the patriarch of the Klopex is a doctor.
Yeah.
So he goes into the ambulance with Tom Hanks and basically spills the beans that, yes, they are murderers, and he's going to now murder Tom Hanks. And a crazy ambulance driving scene where the pizza dude crashes into a tree, and Corey Feldman yells out, "Pizza dude!" Pizza dude! Made me laugh so hard Corey as Feldman, a 13-year-old.
Maybe this is my dad's influence, but I feel like Corey Feldman's my favorite character in this movie.
Yeah. But anyways, so that's kind of how it wraps up. And everybody is happy at the end, except for the Klopex.
Okay. You
know, they're busted.
I know that you love this movie. Do you kind of wish, there's part of me that wishes that they had been wrong about the Klopex, like that would have made it even funnier. Like, had they gotten it all wrong?
I don't know. I think that there's a part of it that plays well because they're vindicated for all the crap that they went through to figure it out. I think that if they hadn't have been the murderers, I think it would have just ended kind of on a sad note because part of their story is that their previous house burned down, and you kind of imagine that something similar may have happened, you know, time after time after time, where they have to keep moving because they're just a little bit different and they're a little bit weird, and the neighbors, you know, continually burn down their house. And so I think that it would have just turned out to be kind of a sad ending at the end.
Well, and I'm like, there would probably have to be more rewrites than what I'm talking about, but it's like, there's part of me that wishes they, I think it's Tom Hanks at some point, he says, you know, we're the crazy ones. We're the ones who are like mowing our lawn. Sure. And so there's something that's going back to the Munsters. That's it's a little like Cousin Marilyn from the Munsters. It's like they sort of view her as the weird one, even though she has it all together. And so there's something kind of nice about that I like, where it's the people who seem like they have it all together, that they're the weird ones. And so that would have been an interesting twist to me that I personally would have liked to have seen in this movie.
I will say that even so, before you even find out the truth about the Klopex, like, there is just a little bit of a sadness to them when they pull up. They see that, you know, somebody's in their basement because there's this huge glowing light. They leave. They get the cops. They come back, which is an interesting ploy by the Klopex, because they are guilty, but they bring the cops back, which is well, bold.
Okay.
But,
and did they ever, like, I mean, yes, the Klopex were murdering people, but do we ever find out why?
I guess not. I mean, we don't know why they murder people. The only people that we know that they have murdered are the previous owners of the house, who are the Knapps.
Yeah.
But when they open up the trunk to the car that they're in, there's like 50 skulls in their trunk. So,
which I would argue that's kind of sad as well. The fact that 50 people have perished at the hands of these weirdos.
Yeah, true. You know, one other question I had about the Klopex is, you know, there's one scene where Tom Hanks is watching them in the middle of the night, and they're digging what looks like graves in their backyard. And then later on, when the Klopex go out of town, Tom Hanks and Art go to basically dig up the whole backyard, and they don't find a shred of evidence. And that was another scene where I was like, well, what was the whole point of the first scene then? So yeah. I guess just a little bit of misdirect, but yeah, no, it is a great movie to me. I think it's hilarious at the end where, after the ambulance does crash, Tom Hanks is yelling, "Citizens arrest!" Just every single thing. The only thing I will say I didn't like about this is at the very end, where Corey Feldman kind of breaks that fourth wall, looks directly in the camera and is like, man, I love this street or whatever. Yeah. I could have done without that, to be honest. But anyway, so that's the movie. I'll go ahead and ask you. I think it's pretty obvious that I'm kind of a 5 out of 5 balls here, but I'll ask you, what do you rate it?
Well, I think like I said, what I admire most about the movie is that it's unique, and I have not seen a movie like The Burbs before or since. You know, like I've seen quirky movies. I mean, Tim Burton, and you know, to some degree, someone like Wes Anderson or someone like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll do movies that are offbeat and like things that are different, and I always appreciate that when someone avoids sort of cookie cutter Hollywood movies. And, you know, that's kind of how I felt about Big Trouble Little China as well. I think there's so much potential with the premise that there's some ways that I don't feel like they quite hit it. And especially that ending. Like I felt like the ending could have been better, but like you said, there's a lot of laughs in it. It's got Tom Hanks. Like you put Tom Hanks in a crappy movie and it's still going to be pretty watchable and entertaining. So I'm gonna give this 4 out of 5. I think it's a pretty solid rating. It's no Santana and Rob Thomas, but
yeah, no, I
should play a clip of that song.
Yeah, we were cleaning out the garage today, and that song came on my Spotify playlist that I was playing. And forget about it. I immediately was like, nope, can't do it. Next one. But yeah, you know, the thing about this movie that I think is great is that these jokes, while they're smart in the idea of, you know, they're clever, they're not like highbrow jokes. You know, I think of a Wes Anderson film as kind of a higher brow kind of humor, where it's not just, I mean, obviously he does have some funny marks in his movies where anybody could laugh, but overall it's definitely kind of set at a higher bar of smart comedy. But these jokes they're clever, but they're not smarty pants jokes. they're you know, a 13-year-old is able to laugh at them, and a 45-year-old is able to laugh at them. But then to play that with, I mean, I think that there was probably a push in the mid-90s with some of the Screams and the I Know What You Did Last Summers that they tried to kind of play some humor into these horror movies. But this is a straight up kind of, it's not a horror movie, but it's got elements of that, with the comedy kind of just being an umbrella over the whole movie. And I just think it's, yeah, beat for beat, you know, never misses. So I'll give it the 5 out of 5. Surprise that it is.
Yeah.
So that leaves us.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. It was my ringtone.
So when I call you.
Yeah. I don't know, Brad, can you, this is.
what is the name? The Santana. You know what? I like 60s and 70s Santana. All right.
Yeah. But
he went wrong with that. What is that song called?
It's called Smooth.
Smooth. That's right.
It's been listened to over
700 million times.
Well, 210 million. And that's just on Spotify. Like, I think I accidentally heard it 2 million times in the late 90s.
On the radio.
Yeah. I was like, nah, turn it.
Well, we get to go back to the sports movie Wheel of Death.
Yeah.
Back to the grind of what we came here to do and review sports movies.
That's right. Come on, Rocky II. Let's do this.
Let's spin the wheel. It is 189. Okay. I think I know what this is. This is an oldie, but it was, I got to look it
what
up.
Was that, because... what was that movie from the 30s we watched?
Kid Galahad.
Yeah, Kid Galahad.
Yeah, this is a Mickey Rooney, Elizabeth Taylor joint. Oh. Yeah. It's called National.
I was doing that for Mickey Rooney. Were you doing it for Elizabeth Taylor?
Hey, you know, whatever floats your boat.
I was doing that for that Asian character that Mickey Rooney is always taking flack for playing.
So Angela Lansbury is also in this movie.
Oh yeah, double
young Angela Lansbury. So this is called National Velvet. It's a horse racing movie.
Angela Lansbury plays the horse, I do believe, if I'm not mistaken.
I put this is Mickey Rooney the jockey?
I don't know. I'm assuming we'll cut all this out, like the last 5 minutes.
That's gold, right? That's the best part of the episode. So there's a few older movies because they're sports movies, and we don't discriminate about movies that are made in the 30s or 40s or whatever. But
there's no ages.
This one, this one was definitely put in because it did win a couple of Academy Awards. So we can discuss that later. But yeah, next one, National Velvet. It's going to be our most popular podcast episode ever. And then maybe the next one after that, maybe Coach Carter or something.
Okay. All right. So. National Velvet.
All right. Well, again, we do have our Twitter page. It is at Slow Pitch Cast. We have our Instagram, which is at Slow Pitch Podcast. You can support us at patreon.com/slowpitch.
Yeah.
And we appreciate you listening to The Burbs. Next week, National Velvet.
Peace out.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball.